It is a core drive. We need to overcome the problem areas that have been created by people exploiting and imposing beauty standards. But it's partly by knowing that this is happening and not just letting it happen, and which I think, so my challenge to anyone listening would be in charge of your own aesthetic development. Don't just accept the passive. What you like right now may not be the things you would really like. I mean, our aesthetic character changes. What we liked 20 years ago, we may not even like anymore. So knowing that, how do you want to shape your aesthetic future?
I'm Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast about how beauty shapes our world and the work that we do. In this season, we're looking at beauty in science. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. More about them later in the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our latest episode. I'm so thrilled to welcome my guest today, Michael Spiker. Dr. Michael Spiker is a public philosopher and creator of Aesthetics Research Lab. He writes and speaks about aesthetics in professional and academic contexts. He's a regular contributor to Beauty Matter, a resource for the beauty industry. Michael lectures at both Boston Architectural College and Massachusetts College of Art and Design. He co-edited a forthcoming volume with Bloomsbury Visual Arts called Digital Fashion, Theory, Practice, Implications. And he's working on another book called Is Your Business Beautiful? Michael, thank you for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Brandon. It's great to be here.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, I've really been following your work. I really, really enjoy your writing on various platforms. And I'm curious as to how you got into philosophy and then into the study of aesthetics in particular. Tell us a bit about your journey.
So my gateway into aesthetics is through art. I have a background in art. I paint and I play music, and I've always had kind of an affinity for the arts. And how I got, so that's sort of the longer story to that maybe, but then how I got into philosophy was actually through aesthetics, which is a strange path. I took this course, and the professor made a comment. He said, I should clarify, the course had nothing to do with aesthetics or art or anything. It just was, he just happened to throw out this example. And he said, of course, beauty couldn't possibly be just in the eye of the beholder. And I thought, wait, what? Because having a background in art, I had always been taught the opposite. And so, I asked him after class and he explained, and, you know, I had no real background in aesthetics or philosophy. I mean, I had read a little bit of Kierkegaard and some other philosophers, but I really didn't have much of a really strong foundation. And so learning about aesthetics was my introduction to really doing philosophy. And it's kind of stuck. That was in about 2002, and it's kind of stuck that way for the last 21 years. And my interest in aesthetics keeps growing. And so and it just keeps expanding in different ways. This goes maybe beyond what you had originally asked, but because of my connection with art, I always assumed that studying aesthetics, art, artists, art museums, so on, were kind of was my main context. And about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, I had two different occasions with two different people, and they both kind of drew the same conclusion. They said, well, maybe, you know, architects and designers are your people. And then I thought, well, you know, why stop there? So part of my motivation is this idea that aesthetic experience is a basic human good, or I prefer actually saying a basic reason for action. I think the word good gets a little bit confusing for people, you know, especially in philosophy. So if aesthetics is such a pervasive part of an integral part of human existence, then why do we not talk about it in almost every context imaginable?
Yeah. No, that resonates so much for me. And that's part of the motivation for, I mean, the work I'm doing as well. And I think I got into aesthetics, from a completely different field, which was the study of protest movements and looking at motivation for why do people protest, right? This was around probably 2009, and the theories around the time were talking about negative emotional shock, moral outrage, as being sort of a fundamental emotional driver. And this is around the time when emotions were being, this is kind of the emotional turn in the social sciences, and it had gone from being this irrational thing that people had dismissed to being actually something valuable as sort of a fundamental motivation for action. And I was struck by how just the accounts of protests seemed to neglect a sort of a flip side to this moral shock, which is if there's some sort of outrage at the loss of something, it seems to imply there was something good or something beautiful, perhaps, that had been taken away or that was under threat, right? And so I stumbled upon a lot of interesting work, particularly I think Elaine Scarry's work on beauty and justice, and which is a Harvard philosopher. I'm not sure what her field is actually, but she wrote this book on beauty and justice. And then I came across some writings by Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Dorothy Day and so on, talking about beauty, right, as a motivator for justice. And so so that's kind of what I think has driven my interest here. When you had started out, could you maybe tell us a little bit about your background in the arts, and were you hoping to go on professionally in that field, or did you have to then make a switch into becoming a philosopher? Like, what was that process like for you?
That's a very long story, so I'll just kind of summarize it by saying that I thought maybe I was going to go to art school, and I had considered that for a while. And then I realized that I really enjoyed talking about some of these things more than just doing them. I wanted to help motivate other people to do it. So to think through some of these things. So I know that's sort of ambiguous. I always knew that I would keep doing it. I actually took a 20-year hiatus from painting. So, I've only like maybe eight years ago or so gotten back into it. But, so I just kind of was motivated more toward thinking through these things. And I guess I think getting involved in philosophy really did make a difference for me, because I really wanted to, think more deeply about things. And that kind of became my driving force more than creating.
Okay. You'd mentioned aesthetics as a fundamental motivation for action. Could you say more about what you mean there?
So the idea came from John Finnis, his book Natural Law and Natural Rights from 1980 or 81. And in the book, he says there are seven basic human goods. Like I said, I don't really like the word good, because I think it just gets too confusing, and especially in the context of philosophy. But so I prefer a basic reason for action, which is another term that he uses, and others in that kind of same thought. And he actually claims, and I kind of like this, he claims that that these goods are self-evident, but they're generic enough where, or general enough, not generic, general enough where there's not just one way to pursue them. So knowledge is one, life, which includes health, friendship, play, which I thought was really exciting, that I think that's an underdeveloped one. And aesthetic experience. Well, aesthetic experience, he writes six sentences about it, and that's the only mention of aesthetic experience in this book. And so I sort of took the challenge to develop that into a bigger thing. He says that it's self-evident. And what does that mean? Obviously it doesn't mean that everyone's going to agree. Not everyone's going to exactly recognize the value, or at least not in the same way. But I think he offers two ways of kind of illustrating why this is a fundamental thing. And one is, it's sort of simple. Just observe what people do. People spend time, money, and energy, to present themselves a certain way that, oftentimes it makes them feel good. I mean, there are other things at work, of course, social pressures and different things. So I'm not trying to diminish those. Yeah. But we spend time, money, and energy to decorate our homes, our offices, our, you know, all these things. We travel all around our countries and the world to see things made by humans and that are natural that we believe will give us some kind of aesthetic experience. There might be other reasons too, like for like history and other things as well. But surely aesthetic experience is one of the motivators. So that's one kind of way is just observe what people do. And you'll see that they're motivated by this. And then the other thing is imagine, what it's like without aesthetic properties, without positive aesthetics in your life. And, you know, we don't have to go far to imagine that. We have places all over this country that have these, they're called prisons. They have, former, incarcerated person turned poet, Reginald Dwayne Betts, at a talk, I saw once said, there's no beauty in prison. It had nothing to do with aesthetics. He just sort of offered this as a side comment. We can imagine what that's like. I personally, before I had any of the vocabulary that I have and any of the knowledge of theories and ideas of aesthetics, I personally, walked through, the projects in a major US city and realized if I lived here, I could feel the oppressiveness because of the complete lack of any aesthetic considerations. And, so for me, that's kind of what I mean by a basic reason for action is it's such a core, it's necessary for human flourishing. And this is where I've kind of recently, I hadn't really given Maslow's hierarchy of needs much thought in, I don't know, a long time. And it recently came up and I thought that's a huge problem that it's called a hierarchy. It sends the wrong message, I think. And, yes, we can technically stay alive with food, water, and shelter, but what kind of a life is that without, aesthetics and, other like meaningful work and play and relationships and things like that? I mean, it's not really much of a life. And so, on a very technical level, yes, those things are slightly more important, but not really. for the kind of life we all would aspire toward.
The hierarchy metaphor is a bit is misleading, isn't it? It's almost as though you need to have concentric circles with you know the sort of the self transcendence at the center, because that is something that allows people to somehow persist. Like I mean, like Viktor Frankl would talk about meaning being so vital, even in contexts in which we're deprived of food and shelter and safety and so on. Right.
Since you mentioned Viktor Frankl, one of my favorite stories that kind of like people often think of aesthetics as something that you throw onto your life once it's already going well or something. And, one of my favorite stories that kind of challenges that idea is from Primo Levi, his book, If This Is a Man. He talks about while he was in Auschwitz, he and a fellow prisoner were responsible for walking across the camp to get the daily ration of food for that day. And so, of course, they took the most circuitous route possible. And as they're walking, it becomes apparent. I think the other guy was a little bit younger, maybe. It becomes apparent to Primo Levi that this other guy, had never read Dante. So it's like, fresh audience to recite portions of Dante. And he says, he recites it and then he gets to a point and he cannot remember this connecting line. And he makes a bold claim. He said, I would have given up my daily food just to remember this. And keep in mind, they're at Auschwitz. They're not getting lots of food. Like if I skip breakfast, it's no big deal. I can have lunch, and I eat extra during lunch to make up for it. He said I would have given up the daily, food just to remember this line. And then he goes on to explain why. He said, because for a few moments, I forgot who I was and where I was. And he's in like one of the worst situations imaginable. And, so to me, I kind of use that, to draw the conclusion that if in the worst situation, you can rely on beauty and art and aesthetics to kind of transcend even for like a few moments. Life is pretty stressful. It may not ever be as bad as that or as acutely bad as that, but we have lots of terrible things happen to us in life, and we need to develop a repository of these kinds of experiences for those moments, for those, dark times.
Wow. That's really, yeah. I mean, almost, yeah, like storing these experiences, for the times in which they'll be really valuable to us. I mean, some have argued that, this is potentially a kind of distraction from the things that matter, right? The kind of the charge of aesthetic experience as a kind of escapism, as a, maybe kind of even, a Marxian argument would say this is another sort of opiate, right? That's kind of sedating us and preventing us from attending to the changes we need to make in the world. How do you respond to those kinds of critiques?
I would actually respond with a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "We fly to beauty as an asylum from the terrors of finite nature." I actually finally found that quote. It's embedded in the middle of his 1,000 pages of journals. And I can see why anything could become that. Like, people have, described religion as the opiate of the people, aesthetics. I think it's a valid point that you could go too far with it. And this is where I would say part of the thinking behind the basic goods, that, whatever, even if someone has a slightly different list or way of framing them, none of them should be woefully neglected. And I think that's a key component. Like, it may be any given moment we might focus on one a little bit more than the others. A student might focus on knowledge acquisition more than other, more than aesthetic experience or play or something, for a semester, we can imagine. But, neglecting any of those is a problem. Completely neglect. Mm-hmm. Part of the role of the state, according to this theory, is, the natural law theory, is that the state should make it possible for people to pursue all of the goods. And so I think it's a valid criticism insofar as anything could become like that. It's the same thing with, the people in the beauty industry or critics of the beauty industry challenge, beauty standards. Yes, beauty standards are used to exploit people sometimes. And that's a problem. That's a real problem. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean beauty is a problem. I mean, we clearly have some kind of a drive for it. And I think trying to tease those things apart is where it becomes a little bit important, and saying, yes, there are some of these, problems, but we can correct them and still pursue beauty.
Yeah, no, that's a good, it's a really good point. And I think it is a challenge for a lot of people. I mean, because of those sort of exploitative, the negative aspects, right? And think of someone like Tressie McMillan Cottom, who's written about sort of the ugliness of beauty and, looking at the ways in which beauty standards and ideals of beauty have been imposed, right? Essentially on, women in particular, and the role of, say, colonialism, of sexism, of racism in sort of conditioning those standards and then making life unbearable for those who don't fit into those standards, right? If you're a young African-American woman and you don't see in the magazine someone who looks like you, and if you're overweight or something, you don't see someone like you who is being held up as beautiful, and you learn to see yourself as ugly. So those kinds of challenges are fairly difficult, I think, to navigate for a lot of people. And then, of course, the influence of beauty culture, is really kind of pernicious. I mean, through advertising and through just the kinds of the ways in which kids in school can be cruel around these matters. And so, how does one not throw out the baby with the bathwater in those cases, right? So, what does one do? Is there an option to not just sort of jettisoning the concept of beauty?
Yeah, I mean, for that, I would actually recommend Nancy Etcoff's book, Survival of the Prettiest. And then the subtitle is The Science of Beauty. I think she offers a really great analysis of this, because the book is focused specifically on human beauty and why we might have these drives. And as far as the science goes, the book was written in 1999, so there's definitely been a lot of progress in neuroaesthetics and empirical aesthetics since then. However, I think her main points are still good, is we need to recognize that we do this. We need to recognize in ourselves that I unintentionally might show favoritism to someone I find attractive over someone that I find less attractive. And being aware of it is the first step to overcoming it. But realizing, why do I have these drives? And maybe some of the drives aren't maybe some of our instincts aren't as accurate as they once needed to be. So we could imagine, say, you know, 5,000 years ago, someone with more visible condition, like a cleft lip. We might have thought 5,000 years ago, they have some disease that could kill us all. Cause we didn't know what it was.
Right.
We know what it is now. We know that it's not going to kill us. We know that, there's easy operations, to fix that. So we have these instincts, and they have our instincts that have come from thousands and thousands, or maybe even, you know, years of development. The science has progressed a lot quicker than our instincts. So, we have to work on overcoming that I do think that's at least part of it. And recognizing that we do these things. I think that's sort of the basic idea.
Is it that this is a kind of, you know, so maybe to reframe Finnis's language, this is maybe a basic human drive that we really can't do without. We might pretend we can do without the sort of, let's call it this aesthetic drive, like to trust people that we find, attractive or to be drawn towards beautiful objects. Right. And, you know, I think of, Roger Scruton, who argues that beauty is a reason to attend to an object in the same way that truth is a reason to believe a proposition, right? And you don't need another reason. That is the reason, right? So yeah, if someone asks you why you're looking at this and you say it's beautiful, you don't have to say, well why does that justify your attention to it, right? So maybe then, awareness, just so that we're more thoughtful about, is the issue then this is a kind of second order judgment, and we can ask ourselves, but ought I to trust this person because I find them beautiful, or ought I to attend to this, and then you can sort of reflect on it and then maybe change your direction. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, once you're aware, then what?
Yeah, no, I think, it is difficult because we have these instincts, and you don't want to trust someone that looks a little scary, and then and then you follow them down a dark alley or something,
Right, so, right. Yeah.
That we need to be wise in it, but I think I think most people aren't aware of how the subconscious affects us in our actions, and I do think that's an absolute key component. And even people that study some of these things admit, I know I'm affected by this too, even though I'm aware of it. So it's not like we'll solve it. It's just, the fact that we are at least more conscious of it, begins to help. But I think focusing on maybe, I was going to say the right things, but I don't know if that's really the right word phrase I want to use, but I think learning the distinctions between what beauty is versus how it might play out in a culture, because what we've kind of discovered, and I say we meaning the empirical aesthetics folks, is that there's actually a larger agreement when it comes to naturally occurring things like faces and sunsets and flowers, where we have very sharp disagreement. Where beauty might be in the eye of the beholder more specifically is, in human-made things, art and architecture, because, there's a multitude of ways of applying, the characteristics of beauty to art and architecture. And we just have to apply it differently. And so we tend to, favor things that we are familiar with. And an example I can give, comes from, years ago, someone had gone to India and brought back a CD. Those things from many years ago.
Yes, I remember those.
he had a CD of the Indian hand drummer Zakir Hussain, and when I first heard it, it was jarring because it was so different from anything I had ever heard. And I could have stopped there. I could have said, "Oh, okay, I guess I just don't like this." But I felt like from his recommendation and, from different things, I felt like, well, I need to kind of push through a little bit. And, I don't know all the science behind it, but there are some people that have, that to my memory of it have suggested, and maybe further than that, but I'll say suggested that things that we're not familiar with, our brain doesn't know quite how to process it, and so yeah. It has to learn that, and then we can make an aesthetic judgment or something. And so I think that's kind of what happened. I had to kind of listen to it a little bit, get familiar with. And then this happens even without going to a completely different country. I mean, someone that listens to classical music that hears punk music for the first time, that's no clue. It just sounds like noise. And they're right. To them, it does sound like noise because they don't know how to process it. And then once they do, and then they could maybe pick it apart in other ways. But I think there's that element comes into play as well.
Yeah. So there's a couple of dimensions to it, right? One is to be able to have the experience of doing something. And yeah, I can, there are pieces of music that I, admire because I know how to play that instrument. I realize how challenging it would be to do that. Or, like a vocal technique would be really, how do they do this? And it's just this, but if someone is not familiar or hasn't had that experience of training or trying to do those things, they don't realize how challenging it is. And I think sports are kind of similar. I mean, watching, somebody like Steph Curry, do a three-pointer, might look kind of like that. That seems kind of, simple, but unless you've tried it, you don't realize how complicated it is to do something that looks so effortless, right? But then also having a guide, someone who can help you to understand the aesthetic criteria and judgments at play in a field. And when I talk to scientists about beautiful equations, I don't know what those equations mean. They look like just Greek characters there. And so unless I understand what it means, it's can't access it.
And I think the only other thing I'd add is that we have this very, we don't necessarily think about it consciously, but we have this kind of, there's a distinction between active and passive taste. And I think it comes from, the literal taste. If you put food in your mouth, you will taste it. But there's a difference between that and someone that's a connoisseur that really understands all the different flavors and the way it affects and or how to properly. There's certain drinks, wine and scotch might be two of them, and certain foods that maybe there's a proper way of consuming it that. Gets all the flavor out of it that someone that doesn't know how to do that isn't going to get. And so in the same way, we often, people often say, my experience, a lot of music people listen to comes from their older siblings or their friends or things, and they don't really think much about it. When they're younger, they might not, I should say, maybe some might, but or their parents sometimes, it's not, they didn't go out and seek, I'm going to find the music that is right for me. And it's often just passed down and it's very passive in that sense. But, I think we need to be much more active in and intentional about figuring out what aesthetic things we like. And I think that's also a way to counteract the negative sides is we often just sort of take it in and I don't think there's a way to completely remove the passive side. Because I might just stumble upon a painting and in an art museum and not have expected it. But there's a sense in which being intentional about it helps us shape our own, let's call it an aesthetic destiny for it to make it sound very positive.
Being more intentional, being more aware, and taking more sort of a sense of agency about sort of, the kind of, aesthetic portfolios that we cultivate and articulate, right, is important. Talk about the distinction between aesthetics and beauty. I mean, we've been kind of touching on those terms, but how do you distinguish those? Is beauty a sort of a subcategory of the aesthetic? How do you think through that?
Well, I'd say I think dictionary definitions have not done aesthetics a good service. Last I looked, aesthetics was defined in dictionary as the study of art and beauty. I think that's a strange definition. I can sort of see why they say it, but even going back to Hegel's massive two-volume lectures in aesthetics, he opens with, I'm calling it lectures of aesthetics, but aesthetics doesn't make any sense for this. what he's really going to talk about is philosophy of art. Even since Hegel mentions this a couple hundred years ago, philosophers who are normally good at making distinctions somehow still conflate aesthetics and philosophy of art. So that's one kind of distinction to make. Yes. So aesthetics, I would say, is the study of the broader categories of what is beauty, what is taste, what is aesthetic experience, what is the sublime, and how do these things play out in our lives, and what value do they bring, and those kinds of questions. Mm. Whereas philosophy of art, I would think, is what is the value, nature, and purpose of art, and maybe getting to questions of ethical responsibilities of artists and those kinds of questions, and what makes one object a work of art while another object is not a work of art. So that'd be sort of the first kind of distinction.
Yeah.
And then as far as the difference between aesthetics and beauty, beauty I would put as a sub concept under the broader heading of aesthetics. So I do think aesthetics and aesthetic experience is the experience of the beautiful and other properties. The only thing I would say about aesthetics, is that it also encompasses negative things, ugly,
yeah,
disgust,
right.
We don't really use this word, but the deformed, which I think is not necessarily, about people, even though we often have used it that way in the past, but I think it's about about a business that's kind of not functioning well. You might think of it as, we might not use the word again, but we might think of it as deformed, rather than well formed. So that would be the aesthetics. And then beauty, I think of, it's difficult to define. And we could offer like someone like Anjan Chatterjee might offer a biological definition. There could be a sociological definition, a psychological definition, and a philosophical definition. I would prefer to think of it more as, rather than offering a definition, insofar as these terms are different, I would maybe think of it as a theory of beauty rather than a definition. And a theory of beauty for me would encompass what kind of conditions do we regularly see in beautiful things that we describe as beautiful. And I would say those are things going back to proportion, which I think of as the oldest condition of beauty, going back to Plato and Aristotle. Thomas Aquinas also added integrity and radiance to his list. Roger Scruton talks about fittingness in his little beauty book. We have Francis Hutcheson, who talks about beauty is uniformity amidst diversity, which I thought was a principle rather than a condition, maybe. And Aristotle talks about order. So all these things kind of together help give us a picture of beauty without putting it in any one of these boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, the most common question I get often when I, talk to people about this project, and, it's just like, what do you mean by beauty? How do you define it? And everyone wants to figure out like some kind of way to wrap their minds around, I think everyone has instinctively something they associate with beauty, but, to sort of nail down what it means. Right. And I think that at some level it's, I think simply has to do with the attractiveness of the real, or you could even include, imagination as part of that, as within the scope of, what we would consider reality. Right. But there's something to do with attractiveness. But Scruton, I think, he argues you can only have platitudes about this, right? Like that beauty has to do with the judgment of taste, and that, it has to do with things that please us. And, that some things can be more beautiful than others. And you can create a set of those kinds of statements around it. And it seems like, am I correct in understanding you're doing something similar, as saying we can say some things about what beautiful things are, or what an experience of beauty is, or an encounter with beauty looks like, but we can't really have just sort of a one sentence like beauty is X.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think for the sake of a particular project, you could have a working definition for the scope of the project, and things like that. But I think getting any kind of real rigid, and I think the concepts of aesthetics, art and beauty need to maintain some kind of flexibility. And the thing is, we think this is so unique to these, and that's why we say, oh, these things are completely subjective. It's true of science. There could be some science that we haven't even invented yet. That will revolutionize science in 500 years from now or something, or even 100 years from now, or even 50 years from now, and that we haven't even considered. We call things like even the fact that we call computer science now, that wasn't a, I mean, I don't know if people think of it as a literal science. I actually genuinely don't know that, but we call it computer science. We call it political science. These things wouldn't have been considered that. I don't know exactly when, but if we go far enough into the past, and there are other sciences that, you know, we wouldn't have considered. So science has some flexibility to the term too. So it's not that art, beauty, and aesthetics are completely unique in this. And I think that's a mistake we make all the time in thinking, like when we say beauty is in the eye of the beholder and art is just subjective and aesthetics is just whatever, you know, whimsical or something. There's clearly an element of, and I think, philosopher Crispin Sartwell, his entry Beauty in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy and his, recent book, Beauty, a Quick Immersion, talk about, this objectivity versus subjectivity debate in beauty. And I think he kind of concludes this is sort of a silly debate at this point. There's clearly something at work with both of these sides. I know that's not his argument, but that's sort of his conclusion. But, and he even goes back to people like Immanuel Kant and David Hume, who clearly had a subjective notion of beauty, but he shows that they thought there's something missing if we completely reduce beauty to subjectivity. Like there's at least some seed or kernel. And I think that's where these conditions come into play because, while there may be a, like, if I kind of tell my art students sometimes, like, if I were to tell you to do a painting that uses proportion, I mean, that's so open-ended. You could come up with a million different things of applying proportion. And we've seen it in art history, to apply proportion. Some take a very literal, like a Catholic cathedral is very literal in that it's very symmetrical. But there are other things, like a Japanese rock garden that has a kind of harmony and balance that we might think of as a more metaphorical use of proportion. But it still is there, and there are very different ways of applying it in similar settings.
You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, a global research center located at the University of Southern California. IACS works to create dialogue, spark ideas, and sustain academic research on Catholic thought, creative imagination, and lived experience. Learn more at iacs.usc.edu. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review.
So would you say that, I mean, because you have on the one hand, maybe a very simplistic kind of objectivist understanding of beauty that, you know, I think some people still put forward, right? That there are beautiful objects and we can know what they are. And there's beautiful architecture that is objectively beautiful. And if you don't understand it or appreciate it, something's wrong with you. And then on the other end, that it's all completely subjective, that this just in the eye of the beholder. Is there a kind of middle ground and, you know, or like, is it that there are certain kinds of, say, aesthetic principles that everything we would consider beautiful typically shares, and how those principles are distributed in any particular object of beauty would vary. In some cases, there's much more proportionality. Maybe it, you know, fits the golden rule. In other cases, maybe it's something like meaningfulness, right? And which is one of those components of Anjan's aesthetic triad, right? Why we find certain things beautiful is because we find them culturally and personally meaningful, regardless of, you know, the sort of aesthetic objective properties. But yeah, I'm curious to know what you think of that.
Yeah, I think I would still go back to these kind of conditions of beauty, proportion, radiance, integrity. As I think by saying that it's subject, I think sometimes we misuse these words, objective and subjective. One of the biggest criticisms I've heard from anyone arguing for a more objective notion of beauty is sort of like this rhetorical question, like, well, who are you to say what beauty is.
Right.
And that's not what the objectivity of beauty means at all. I mean, that doesn't mean someone out there didn't try to also do that, but yeah. It means that there is something that to be discovered.
Yeah.
Or like a goal to strive toward. And I think that, and that there's something about the object. So when we talk about proportion and wholeness, integrity and radiance, there's something about the combination of those things with the object. And to use philosophical terms, there's something about the uniting of this form with this matter that does something. And that's where that's to me where the mystery is. Like, why is it that this does something? It's why is it that, I think about this in the context of music. Why is it that one person could play something on guitar that moves me and a different person plays those same notes and it doesn't have an effect on me? And there's something about it. I heard someone once play a guitar solo by Jimi Hendrix and it was technically very good. I mean, the guy was a very accomplished guitar player. It just didn't have the emotional impact that listening to the original Jimi Hendrix does. And I think there's something about that's where the mystery for me is. And I'm okay with the mystery. I think some people are not okay with that. I think the mystery of that, of why this combination does something and this other combination doesn't. But this is, you know, this is going back to Immanuel Kant, who said, there is no formula that we can come up with that can guarantee the creation of beauty. But this is why, I mean, I think this is why he punts to the genius as the artist, because somehow the genius sort of figures out, maybe even by accident, but or habit, figures out how to combine these things together to create beauty. And someone that just doesn't have that level of genius doesn't. And I'm not necessarily espousing that view, but I think that's why I think that makes sense that some people can manipulate paint on a canvas in a way that others just can't. There's an instinct to the way someone uses brush strokes and someone else just doesn't have that. And I don't know what to call it. Kant and others in the modern philosophy period, he's not the only one. So they called it genius. But, there's something about it. And it could, you know, whether it's nature or nurture, whether it's just practice over time. Because clearly, you know, someone who's a painter, their first time they touched a paintbrush probably didn't have that same level, you know. But through habit, through experience, and through maybe some kind of instinct that they just happen to have. And that's where I think there is like I said, there's an element of mystery to it. And I kind of not only accept that, but I kind of like that. I think beauty and aesthetics and art have a kind of mystery to them that I think is necessary for their existence in a sense, a certain amount. But obviously, it was too mysterious. It doesn't mean we can't say anything about it either.
No, that's right. I mean, I think it's not totally elusive, but so we can say there are these certain features and these properties that both of these, say both of those renditions of, say Jimi Hendrix's original and the rendition share in common, but there's some other aspect, that might be different. And so, I mean, it seems like you're saying that beauty is a kind of emergent property, right? That you have these ingredients, and then out of that, there comes this sort of almost a higher order kind of experience. Is it something like that, or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still debating like what that means.
Yeah.
There are philosophers that say that aesthetic properties emerge from non-aesthetic properties. So, the fact that a canvas is square is a non-aesthetic property. That's just the way it is. But the fact that you paint it on the square canvas is what makes the beauty emerge from it. So, I mean, there are people that say that. I don't know if I would come down strictly. At the moment, I'm okay if that's how someone were to interpret my view, but not sure if I would strictly claim that. But I think it's a decent explanation of it.
Yeah. There are people who argue that that we need to tend to aesthetic experience broadly, and beauty is too narrow a focus. And I'm curious to know what you think of that. That we need to really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to agree. I think we focus on beauty. I think the reason we focus on beauty is, to borrow from Arthur Danto's book, The Abuse of Beauty. He the whole book exists to kind of show historically why beauty was kind of removed from art, but that maybe we went too far and almost not only removed it as being necessary, but went the other way and said, we don't even welcome it into art anymore. Yeah. And that did sort of happen historically. But he said the reason why beauty is so important is because it's not just a property, it's a value. And I think that, I think he's right about that. But we have other aesthetic properties, the dainty, the dumpy, the graceful, the elegant, these other things that, you know, you could keep adding on and on. And so I do think we, have these things and we maybe sometimes call them beautiful, even though maybe they're more specific than that. But I think, aesthetics is a gradation. And I think that's something we often miss in our discussions because we talk about, we often use these exemplary experiences, which are, you know, I get it. They're paradigmatic, you know, so we they're easier to talk about talking about a painting versus, you know, a coffee cup or something. But I think we have these smaller level things throughout our daily lives. It could be a coffee cup. It could be, you know, dishware, you know, or it could be a particular brush or, you know, elegant, lamp or something like that that we have in our home. And I think without these things, if we would, our daily lives would be diminished in some respect. And there, you know, there are some personal things, like someone may just not care about coffee cups. Like they, for them, like a coffee cup is purely functional, but something else, I would venture to say there are very few exceptions of people that don't have something like this in their life.
I think that's, it's really crucial, right? I mean, I think both the simple kind of hedonic pleasures we might derive from, you know, seeing a pretty, swatch of color or, you know, a flower or even the sun hitting, you know, the plant on our windowsill in a certain way. I mean, those are things that we may not even pay close attention to it, but they do contribute in some way to our flourishing. Right. And so living a life without those things would be, it's almost like the opposite of like death by a thousand paper cuts or whatever. It's that kind of like, there's the positive aspect of being bombarded by these small, tiny, almost, you know, barely perceptible experience of beauty that I think contribute to life being bearable, contribute to energizing us, right, in ways that I don't think we're often paying attention to. And of course, the deeply meaningful aspects, the experience of the sublime, you know, the experience of awe and transcendence are also important. But I think often we tend to focus just on those and say beauty is about, it's almost like I hear people talk about beauty in a 0-1 sense, like there's either the object's either beautiful or not. And therefore, you know, you should listen to Palestrina and don't listen to these sort of modern people or whatever, right? Because there's no beauty in this form of music, one might argue, right? Which I think is completely misled.
I actually find that more and more disagreements I have with people about a particular object or something is more about the degree. You know, someone may not like a particular musician, but they usually won't say, oh, they can't sing at all. That doesn't happen ever, but I just mean, usually I can tell they can sing, but I just can't get into their music, or I can tell they can play this instrument, but I can't really get into their final product or something. So
you could recognize that that there are, you know, so my wife does not like Jacob Collier, who is, I think, one of the most brilliant musicians alive. And, you know, I mean, his Grammys are evidence of it, but, you know, but she's a trained opera singer and she can't stand his sort of vocal texture. Yeah. And so there's a, you know, so coming from her kind of expertise and experience, she's like, there's, you know, this is not the Stambers really kind of you know, so. But you can appreciate, right? There are these other aesthetic properties. So you can say this object is beautiful, this piece of music is beautiful, it's just it, or in the sense that I appreciate that it has these aesthetic properties, and those are properties that one ought to judge objectively beautiful. It's just that when they come together for me, you know, they're missing something, right?
I think most of the disagreements I've witnessed or been a part of have been more to the degree rather than something is beautiful and something is ugly.
Talk about the Aesthetics Research Lab. What do you do there?
Based on what I said earlier, the idea that aesthetics permeates our lives, and when I began to realize that my focus is not just on art and not just on, and actually when it came to philosophy, the questions about art I find less interesting for me personally. I'm glad people are out there doing it. I find them less interesting. I'm more interested in the aesthetic side, the questions of beauty. And so I started thinking, why are these, you know, if this is so pervasive and so important for our lives, we need to be talking about this everywhere. So I created this website, Aesthetics Research Lab, in 2016 to basically be a resource to bring to together people or ideas that pockets of aesthetics in all sorts of random places. I say random, more maybe unexpected is a better way of saying it. I mean, some expected as well. But, you know, in the context of business, for example, you might expect to find aesthetics in marketing or product design, which that's actually a surprise that it's not as much in product design from people who have worked in product design have told me, as you might think. But you might expect to find it there. But, there's an author, an academic, Stephen DeGroote, if I'm saying his last name correctly, and who wrote a book on organizational aesthetics. I would have never thought to find someone at the time. Now it sort of makes sense now that I've kind of seen it, right. It come up in different places. I've found people writing about aesthetics and, as part of the solution for climate change, prison reform. I keep finding people talking about aesthetics in all these law, politics, all these places that I wouldn't have thought of, you know, 20 years ago, because I would have just connected it with art and nature and a lot of from philosophy and from science. That is those are the big places that people connect, aesthetics is art and nature. And they're good examples because they're, especially art is a little bit controlled in the sense that, the painting doesn't change. So you can constantly talk about this one painting or these groups of paintings or something, especially the ones that are, you know, from the past. But I created it because several of the people I've talked with, they felt kind of alone in where they were coming from. People in business consulting, people in, product design, and they didn't have a place to really talk about these things in their own industries because they felt like they were alone and thinking this is important. And so it exists to be a place where these things can come together, at least on a web page. I'm trying to start organizing more things around it, but for right now, yeah, it's been great.
And is your audience mainly the business community, or who are you primarily engaging?
I have people. So there are definitely academics that I think have been involved in appreciating what I'm trying to accomplish. But there are people in the beauty industry, fashion, business, kind of, which is sort of a broad. And architecture, I think, are the four main groups of industries that I've found what I'm doing resonates with them. And even in fashion and architecture might surprise, and the beauty industry might surprise people, but a lot of people don't talk about the more substantial notions and academic notions of beauty in those industries. Now, architecture might be the exception as it's on the rise. A lot of people are connecting with a lot of the science behind it, not all, but some, you know, are starting to connect with that, the aesthetics, like the neuroaesthetics and empirical aesthetics of the built environment are becoming more prevalent in discussions now, but it's not as much as discussed in the beauty industry or in fashion from my limited experience.
Yeah, that's kind of, which is the, for a lot of people, the default, right? You say beauty and, you know, like you do a Google search on beauty and it's either, you know, like fashion or maybe cosmetics or, you know, that's typically the kind of thing it goes to, right? It's either, one of those things. And, you know, maybe some people might associate with art.
And I should clarify too, it's also from my perspective as a philosopher, like philosophers, when they, if you look at, you know, kind of any of the companion to aesthetics by philosophers, almost none of them have anything to do with the beauty industry or fashion.
Right.
Like their version of applied aesthetics is painting, architecture, literature, music, and those kinds of things. And fashion almost never comes up, but last year actually two philosophers wrote books on it, on fashion. So it's changing a little bit.
Yeah. Well, talk about your book on digital fashion. How did you get into that? And what do you do in your book? What is your book about?
So this June, I have a co-edited volume with, Doris Domoslai Lantner, who's a fashion historian, and Sarah Amelia Bernat, who's a sociologist. And then me as the philosopher, the three of us, had a conversation about maybe we should write something together. And we sort of thought maybe writing an article, and then we all of a sudden came up with this idea of no one has written an academic book. Although, I'll say this on digital fashion. It's fairly new. The pandemic kind of helped push it to the next level of its, it would have taken longer, I think, for it to develop. The pandemic kind of pushed it there because everyone was online a lot more than they were previously, and online in particular ways like Zoom, where companies like DressX have come up with ways of putting like where you could wear digital fashion on a Zoom call. So it doesn't matter what you're wearing physically, you're wearing something else. Even just something simple like digital earrings or something or glasses or something. So we thought, let's do this. And so we have, but rather than write the whole thing, we wanted to, edit it because there's certain areas of technology and things that weren't our area of expertise. And so we didn't want to try and show our weaknesses of that. We wanted to get the people that actually know about this stuff to contribute that. So we have people from all around the world, in the US, me in Boston, and, people in New York, London, and Nigeria, and, South Africa and places. So we have people from different countries writing from on different aspects of it. So we try to, the subtitle is Theory, Practice, and Implication. So we wanted to talk about, some of the theories. So, my chapter is in the theory section on philosophy. There's a chapter actually on neuroaesthetics. There's a chapter, on fashion history leading up to, the development of digital fashion. In the practice section, there is some practitioners, one from the perspective of education, why we need to teach digital fashion or fashion in a particular way. So digital fashion kind of comes from the video game world. I kind of joke that as soon as Miss Pac-Man had a bow to differentiate her from Pac-Man, digital fashion was kind of born. even in video games, like fighting video games where you could switch outfits of your character, like even before before they were on the internet, or connected to the internet, for no real strategic purpose, just for variety's sake.
Yeah.
And preferences. And then we talk about, like, a lot of people think digital fashion is a way to help, not to completely solve, but help alleviate, issues of equity in fashion in like the greater fashion community. And sustainability issues and decoloniality and different things like that. So we have the third section talks about those kinds of implications. But for me personally, my interest in it comes actually from a Supreme Court case in the Netherlands. Two philosophers wrote about it. You know, briefly what happened was two older teenage boys physically threatened a younger boy until he logged into the video game RuneScape and dropped two items. And then one of the older boys logged into the same game and picked those up. And the Supreme Court of the Netherlands ruled that a robbery had taken place, which is interesting. And that was, I want to say that was around 2013-ish or so, when the ruling came down. I think the actual event was earlier. And that to me was interesting because philosophers talk about the nature of reality all the time. Yeah. And so to me, this adds a whole dimension of what the nature of reality consists of. So I kind of wonder so for me, digital fashion, which exists, there's different, I won't get into all this here, but one of the main uses of digital fashion is that it exists only digitally. There are other uses of it that go beyond the scope of this kind of conversation. But for the garments that only exist digitally, that you wear in digital worlds, or if the metaverse ever comes to fruition and the future of the internet is actually 3D, as some people believe, not Facebook's Meta, the actual metaverse that people believe is going to happen.
Right.
any 3D digital environment, you're going to want to wear something. And so that's sort of what
exactly,
people think.
Exactly.
So this is why, what is that? What does it do? Well, digital fashion, unlike physical fashion, can't protect you from the rain, the cold, or the other elements. So even if you, if you go out in the rain and you just need some coat and you just grab some ugly coat that you don't even care about, well, it has a function. Well, digital fashion doesn't have those functions. So like you could imagine someone in a digital environment, doing an oil change wearing a tuxedo because who cares?
Right.
I don't know why you would do an oil change in a digital environment, but the point is, you could do that and it doesn't matter. So you don't have to worry about those kinds of issues. So how do you really want to express yourself? And I think what digital fashion highlights is that we are aesthetic beings. We want to express ourselves aesthetically. And I also connect this with meaning and telling a particular narrative by wearing certain digital garments over others. So I think that's where it plays out. And insofar as digital fashion or any other kind of, you know, whether there is going to be a metaverse or not, they're tools. And I think digital fashion offers us a way to figure out ways of expressing ourselves. And there was actually an article on Beauty Matter recently, not by me, but, that showed how people, Gen Z in particular, has used digital garments and digital beauty ideas to actually shape their physical existence in a good way. Mm. I mean, there's a negative component to it too, but this particular article focused on some of the positive ways that it helps people. And I think that's where it does help. We can try things like, so, you know, for just in terms of clothing, we're limited by physical, financial space, like spaces and financial limitations. Like there's only so many clothes we can buy. Even if we had all the money, I guess if we had all the money, we could build a whole house dedicated to clothes. But so maybe that's not limitation, but we are limited. Whereas digitally, we're not as limited. I mean, they still cost money, but we can experiment with things that we could then bring into the physical world. And virtual try-ons are a way to do that. A lot of companies are beginning to offer this. I just saw that, I believe Balmain, I think it's that company, has now done a good virtual try-on program where you can actually have a digital version of yourself, which they believe will cut down on returns. If you can actually see yourself wearing this. So like, if I look at a model wearing something and I can kind of, you know, maybe I get lucky and the model happens to have some, like it seems about my height or something like that. I get lucky and you know, it has my skin tone and stuff. But that's not always the case where I see a shirt and it looks good on that person, but it might not actually fit me the right way. But if I can actually have my dimensions, you know, and I don't think the technology is going to be perfect right away, you know, but
certainly an improvement, you know, tone of the, you know, particular outfit, or, you know, the color tone there doesn't actually match what it looks like when I get it. Right. And you're looking at this and that's not what it looked like on the screen. Right. I mean, so there are ways for you to actually have a picture or a video where you can see, oh, this actually matches. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Warby Parker was one of the first to do this with glasses.
Right. Exactly.
And it cuts down on returns, which, you know, which cuts down on gas, and a lot of returns, contrary to what people might believe, a lot of returns are put in landfill instead of back on the shelves to be resold. And so, you know, we may have the innocent return where I really thought the shirt was going to work, but it doesn't fit me right or so on. But then we have the sort of less innocent return, for lack of better phrasing, where someone wanted a really expensive shirt or something else because they wanted to post it on Instagram, and then they return it, but they had no intention of keeping it. So some of these companies are saying, well, if all you want, I know this goes beyond the scope of aesthetics, but it does relate because it does have to do with appearances, but if all you want is something to exist digitally, like a shirt for an Instagram post, you can do that digitally now. The imprint on the environment is like 1/1,000,000th or something fraction of the physical garment.
Yeah. So I'm curious that with all of this, I mean, so, you know, just going back to sort of critiques of things like the beauty industry and sort of the concept of something like beauty sickness, right? Which is psychologists talk about, Renee Angell talks about this in terms of just how much, you know, many people, young women in particular, but I think, you know, you could extend it, the issue is they spend a lot of energy on this. And then the argument would be, why not just get people to care less about their appearance, right? Why not just sort of figure out some way to educate away the aesthetic and where this becomes irrelevant, and then they don't have to worry about it. Or, you know, so
I would just say good luck. but I think the drive is too deep for us, and and it really does make us feel better about ourselves. People that get up and get dressed and put some kind of effort into their appearance, they feel better than people that don't. I know that's a broad statement. So I think there are some people that genuinely don't care. But I find it hard to believe that there are people that really, truly, absolutely don't care at all about any of the aesthetics. I think there are degrees, and I think we've become too obsessed, but I don't know how we could completely get rid of it. But I do think companies need to be careful. Of course, I teach on history of aesthetics. We have a section on beauty politics, which the name comes from the Routledge Companion to Beauty Politics. And we talk about issues like colorism and blackfishing and other issues like that that aren't as talked about in these sort of contexts that I've seen, at least from philosophers. And colorism is a pretty strange one for me, because there's no way to advertise your product without making it sound like lighter skin is just better. How else would you advertise that? And so I think that's a problem. I think that's a different kind of problem. But there might be someone that is self-conscious about a particular skin. I'm even hesitant to use the word blemish, but I'll use it apprehensively, where a skin lightening cream might actually serve a practical function. But I actually think one of the ways is through media. When we have movies that frequently have the white man as the hero, that has to have an effect on culture. I just don't believe that it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think it has to have some kind of an effect. And I think it's a responsibility of artists, and especially filmmakers, because that's a big medium, to start changing that narrative.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why we have it, is we keep replicating the same narrative.
Yeah. Talk about, you've got a book that's coming out that you're writing. Is Your Business Beautiful? What, could you say a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, I started talking to a lot of people in business for some reason. It was initially not necessarily intentional. It was intentional insofar as I wanted to broaden the scope with the aesthetics research lab. But and I just kept finding more and more people in business and writings that seem to be the kind of thing that no one talks about. And then public philosopher Tom Morris had a book a while ago called If Aristotle Ran General Motors. And he and I had a conversation about it. In the book, he highlights four transcendentals of Aristotle: beauty, truth, goodness, and unity. And he kind of made this side comment to me once that a lot of the comments he received about the book focused on the section on beauty. And no one really has written, there's definitely some books about aesthetics and business, but no one has really written, especially from the perspective of philosophy. So this is going to be a short book. I haven't really worked out these details yet, but like, I would actually even imagine it fitting the size of these like very, very short introductions to something. It'd be that kind of size book. And the reason why is because I think there's a practical reason. I wanted it to serve a different purpose. I don't want it to be this exhaustive academic treatise. I want it to kind of be more of an inspirational book for people to reorient their perspective of business and beauty and aesthetics more broadly. When you go to an art museum, you're expected to engage with the artwork there. That's sort of why you're going. When you go to a business or your office, even if they have artwork on the wall, I wonder how many times people just walk past it and have never even looked at it. Even if it's good, it may not be very good, and that might be one reason not to look at it. But even if it's very good, I wonder how often people look at it. Or maybe they look at it the first time they walk into their office and they sort of just get focused on their work and then they never look at it again. And I thought, well, this is a way to, why not during some kind of a meeting that you're having, why not bring one of these paintings? You know, if something like some, obviously it has to be something that's easy to transport, but why not bring one of these paintings into your meeting? Or if you have work that maybe isn't easily moved, why not make it a requirement of this meeting to come with having looked at some of these works and see how it inspires you to think about a particular problem that we're, or issue or concern that we have at this company. So what I've done with this book is I've divided it into what I take to be the three broadest categories of business, product, place, and people. Mm. You know, people wonder what philosophers do. We often talk about the broadest questions, not necessarily the better questions, just broader. And so this is me asking, how would aesthetics fit with each of these three categories? With product, it might be, I mean, product design is actually important. And with product, I also include service. Product design, service design, think about the first impression that people have on your product. There was a Harvard business professor named Gerald Zaltman who claims that 95% of our retail purchases are based on the subconscious. And the subconscious is where it's kind of the first impact of aesthetics. And he also talks about emotions, but aesthetics is connected to our emotional to some degree. And, you know, I can speak from very, very personal experience. I was in the market years ago for a brand new, like leather bag. And when we were just looking on the internet, just to kind of get some ideas of what color, what features, you know, what company might make the most sense. We turned a page and my wife literally gasped out loud and it was the one I got. So there is a sense in which this kind of connection. Now, obviously, you know, there are certain products like toothpicks that, you know, we probably don't have an emotional connection with that, but we may have where we buy those things. We may have an emotional connection with whether we go to, Whole Foods some other grocery store or a convenience store to get them. We may have some kind of, I mean, we don't think of it as an emotional connection because we don't think of it as an emotional experience. Like when we think of emotions, we often think of like these extreme emotions. Like I'm weeping. I'm not weeping walking into Target or something. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a kind of emotional connection I have with it. It may be something like I go to a store often enough and know the cashier and, I may not even necessarily know the person's name, but I know their face and they're kind or the person that helps me in a store. I mean, we remember these things. It's the same thing that gets us to not go to a store, a bad emotional connection, like where someone was rude to us. And again, we don't think of it as an emotional connection per se, but it undermines what they were trying to accomplish. A store that has the right, you know, the right vibe, of what we're looking for, what we identify with. So those kinds of things, so that kind of goes into place. And then people, our interactions with people are huge. I mean, suppose you had the most amazing hospital or the most amazing business and you walk into the front desk and the person's just like, yeah, what do you want? But it also, what surprised me about some of the research I've done on this is, I haven't delved into this quite enough yet, but there's some people that said it's not just about being friendly and pleasant. That's part of it. The aesthetics of the people of a place and the employees and so on. It also has to do with the way we communicate. I mean, have you ever been on an email exchange with a person or something and you're like, I have no idea what they're asking of me. And so you do a follow-up email where maybe let's say you ask two follow-up questions and you're thinking, okay, if they answer these questions, I think I'll get what they're trying to see. And then they answer the first one, but not the second one. And then this thing that could have been, so the point is, had they written a more elegant email in the first place, we might never have had to have this like 20 exchange thing to finally get to the heart of what it was they were asking us. It doesn't mean that, you know, it won't alleviate all confusion, but this was an interesting one to me. It came from an article on aesthetics and healthcare, which is one of the main areas I kind of focus my attention on in terms of spaces. Some of the normal stuff I expected about the space, but it had this idea of elegant communication and how the way a doctor presents information to a patient is important, not just, and it's not just the friendliness. It's not just the sensitivity to the, you know, the you know, maybe, gravity of the topic or something, but it's also the way that you present it helps, helps patient. And the problem here is that it really requires getting to know the patient a little bit better, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. You know, so my, the work I've been doing too, is that it's, you know, I suppose there's not, you know, a ton of different options there. You know, I have similarly these, you know, these three P's that you talk about, but two others, one is purpose, which is, you know, there's their beauty and why you do what you do. Right. And then and the other one is the process, so how you work. And I think a lot of what you're talking about in communication, right, is part of it. But just around the, you know, the struggles a lot of people have with work, with business and so on, the issue of burnout, it often has to do with process, right? Often has to do with, gosh, I just can't do, you know, it's just so stressful. I can't do what I need to do in order to accomplish these goals, because all these other, you know, the bureaucracy gets in the way, the red tape is in the way, et cetera, right? So there's ways in which the organizational structures get into the way there. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're really dealing with very similar things, that the experience of business has to do with a lot of these dimensions. And for what it means for work or business to be perceived as beautiful, I think, definitely ties to all these dimensions.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about process, I actually think I have those two ideas in the book, but, I just didn't separate them out. When I think of process too, we often get so caught up in the final product when it comes to work, and that there's a kind of performative beauty in the work that we often ignore. We think about it in terms of people like doing dance. We might think about it. We may not call it this, but we might think about it with athletes, like when they just are on one night, and we might think about it with musicians or actors, but we don't think about it with work. And there is a kind of elegance sometimes, and an aesthetic component to, or a performative beauty to someone's work that we just don't talk enough about. Sometimes making even something like very, very businessy, like making a spreadsheet, sometimes you can just make one. But sometimes you can make one elegantly, and it's not just that the final product is elegant; it's that the process of thinking through it had an actual kind of aesthetic component that gets overlooked, I think, way too easily, and even by the person doing it.
Right. Yeah. So things like flow, you know, I mean, those kinds of experiences, right? So your emotional state, right? Maybe not as a consumer of an object, but in producing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the experience of even like the kind of stereotype of the tortured artist, right? Who's producing this beautiful piece of work, but going through an insane amounts of anguish. So one might try to figure out how do we intervene in that process and make the experience of working itself, right? Be more liberating, more beautiful. There's part of it is a component of knowing how to work skillfully, maybe learning mastery and that there's a maturity component there. But part of it is also, I think, policies and structures, which, you know, the onus is there on the organization to create the conditions for people to thrive.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what I've read, talk about culture of an organization being top down, and that telling the story of your company is important, but also letting the employees tell their versions of the story of the company. And listening, that was kind of an interesting, component to all of this that sort of ties all three things into me at the end. Is the story structure and storytelling and the story, some of the authors I've read on this said that the story itself isn't just to convey information about the company, though it does that. It's also to create, the story has to be good. So it has, the story itself has to have sort of an aesthetic component, which I thought was very often overlooked. I mean, I think a lot of people focus on what's going to grab people's attention, and there are different ways of grabbing people's attention. Sometimes a commercial might shock you in a sense, you know, or surprise you in some way. And that conveys something. But I think, for the core component of your story, needs to be, aesthetically pleasing in a particular way.
Yeah. 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 There's an aesthetics to story structure for sure. Yeah. That's amazing. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been just lovely hearing about all of your work. And
Are there any other aspects of beauty and aesthetics that you'd like to touch on before we end, just to help us understand what beauty is and why it matters? You know, what is there anything left to address that we haven't discussed?
I'm not sure if there's anything new, but I guess I would just reiterate that it is a core drive. We need to overcome the problem areas that have been created by people exploiting and imposing beauty standards. But it's partly by knowing that this is happening and not just letting it happen, and which I think, so my challenge to anyone listening would be in charge of your own aesthetic development. Don't just accept the passive. What you like right now may not be the things you would really like. I mean, our aesthetic character changes. You know, what we liked 20 years ago, we may not even like anymore. So knowing that, how do you want to shape your aesthetic future? And I think that's a key idea, not just for yourself, but for others as well. And how can you begin to recognize creating a habit of recognizing the aesthetics in your daily life? What would life be like if you, some daily object like a coffee cup, was just unappealing? I mean, maybe you have an unappealing coffee cup, but whatever object you have, I mean, think about ways, don't just accept that, things are the way they are. It's too easy to do that. You know, it takes some work for certain things, like they're big, and money sometimes, for big overhauls of like your home or something. So obviously you can't always do that, but you can rearrange things. You can create the aesthetic environment that is most appealing to you. And I think it's worth the effort, to do that. So I would say that would be my last challenge is don't accept, be an active participant in your own aesthetic destiny.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. Where can we direct people to your work?
Aesthetics research.com is my website, and my I have a Substack called Aesthetics Research Lab, which keeps growing, and I'm about to embark on one of the things I bring to the table that we haven't really talked specifically about is the history of aesthetics. I think it's important to see that there's a long-standing tradition of some of these ideas and different ways of thinking about them, which help shape our own current thinking. And so I'm about to do on the Substack, I'm about to start next year at some point. I haven't set an actual date yet because I don't want to commit to something and then I have to delay it. So I'd rather set the date once I have a better sense. A history of aesthetics project on that, that will kind of go through the history, not necessarily in chronological order, and bring it into today. Why does it matter today? Why does it matter? How can we apply Plato and Aristotle, Plotinus, St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas? How can we apply what they said about beauty to now? Why does it matter? Because I don't want to just think about those things, because I think that's another problem with aesthetics is people think it's very abstract. I actually think it's very practical. In some ways, I might even go so far as to say it's the most practical branch of philosophy, but I don't know if I want to say that. I'm sure that's just my bias coming out, but I think it can be very practical, even in light of some of the abstract concepts here and there. But so.
Fantastic. Michael, thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Brandon.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music edited by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. A research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. Learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.